Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Frederick Louise Aldama, who is the editor of Graphic Indigeneity Comics in the Americas and Australasia. So, Frederick, thank you for being here with me.
Thank you, Rebecca. And wow, I'm just like, this is an amazing kind of coincidence, or maybe not. Maybe you timed this perfectly, but also happy, or let's affirm today as Indigenous Peoples Day as well.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for letting us and reminding us of that. So I would love to start with you talking about why you wanted to put this collection together and how it sort of came to be.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca. You know, there has been kind of moments really of important scholarship on comics and indigeneity, Native American comics, North American comics, but nothing that has really kind of pulled them all together. And I thought, my goodness, we need this now. There is such an abundance of comics created around the world by Indigenous creators for Indigenous readers primarily, and secondarily kind of, you know, other non-Indigenous readers. It's time. And so instead of us kind of going moment to moment, kind of like a skipping stone, you know, looking for articles, scholarship on this stuff, I thought, let's just go for it and make the kind of, you know, definitive, at least foundational springboard volume for us to launch from. I'll just add too that, you know, this was a huge challenge in many ways. And, you know, the fact is that I didn't get, you know, all of the kind of scholarship that I was hoping for when I first dreamed of the project, which, you know, probably would have been a multi-volume, huge final product. But what I did get is amazing, and I'm really excited and happy to bring this and help bring this into the world.
So you've divided this into three parts, and so we can talk about each of those parts. But I wonder, before we sort of get into each of the parts and some of the chapters in them, if you can sort of talk about why you made that choice and sort of how you thought about, once you've got the collection, right, once you've got these pieces, how you sort of thought about and divided them.
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of thought does go into how we organize scholarship, how we organize the dissemination of knowledge within sort of big volumes like this. And, you know, the first section's really about kind of showing the world how kind of others have distilled and reconstructed the Indigenous identities and experiences in mostly lazy, careless, and even shamefully denigrative and racist ways. And I start with that because I really wanted to kind of have that echo board for us to understand just how significant Indigenous comics as a movement created by and for Indigenous audiences around the world is so kind of radically different and so radically kind of pushing against this target, say, of denigration, exploitation, appropriation. At the same time, I also wanted to kind of include pieces that do talk about how some non-Indigenous creators like Jack Jackson willfully, you know, brings a great will to style, willfully distilling and reconstructing, doing the homework to make kind of complex representations of, you know, resistance movements like Alcatraz and Wounded Knee, you know, bringing those to readers in and through a kind of underground comics aesthetic. So I wanted to bring, you know, bring to light how it's not that you have to necessarily be Indigenous to create comics, good comics about the Indigenous identities and experiences. It's just that you have to really, like, you know, do your homework. And, you know, this is important. So, yeah, that first section was really all about kind of laying that out. The second section, part two, Decolonial Imaginaries, Terra South, was really about kind of linking our hemisphere, the Americas, together with showing kind of, you know, what was going on in Canada with representations, usually not so good representations, North America, and then over to our brothers and sisters in Australia and New Zealand. And then kind of looking at what's going on in the Southern Hemisphere of the Americas in terms of comics creation by Indigenous creators, in terms of the real significant ways that even Latinx comics creators in the North, in the U.S., are going back to our ancestral histories, Mesoamerican histories, and kind of embracing them and reconstructing them in U.S. spaces for us to really imagine a wider sense of what it means to be Latinx in and through our Indigenous ancestral past and present. And then the third section is really, you know, again, kind of linking us to what's happening in Canada and the incredible comics creations that are working in that space, the Indigenous comics creations that are working in that space to push against legacies of the violence of the coloniality of power, of misrepresentation, all those things that I talk about in the first section. So it's a real celebration of what's going on there, and also a celebration of all variety of kinds of comics, that we're not just doing superhero stories. We're not just doing stories that kind of go back to the past in a speculative space and then reconstruct that in an empowering way. But we're also telling autobiographical story. We're telling history. Indigenous comics creators are really kind of moving into this space, also reshaping the comics form itself through multimodalities. You know, animated video and sound being introduced into digital comics spaces. In the one case, you know, Candida Rifkin and Jessica Fontaine and their scholarly work on this incredible piece, this incredible multimodal comics piece, Will I See, that looks at the tragic murders of Tina Fontaine and Farron Hall, right? Really going into that violence against Indigenous youth and showing us how we can bring that to audiences in an powerful, impactful way.
Right. And so before we get into these chapters and these parts, and I know we will talk about this as we go through, but I want you, I have the book in front of me, and it's beautiful. There's some, well, beautiful and haunting imagery, but there's a great deal of imagery throughout the text. And so can you talk a little bit about that choice and the choice to be able to not only write about these comics, but also represent them in the text?
Yeah, you know, One of the things about comics studies in general is that today we're seeing the power of deep scholarly work in the space of the visual. And the visual is the dominant mode for comic book storytelling. And so for me, it was really important to make sure that we had, the color comics reproduced when we could, or when they were in color, because I talk about this concept in the introduction, but it's really important to understand the ways in which indigeneity is drawn, or what I call geometrized, in comic book narrative arts. And by this, I mean how comic book creators, indigenous comic book creators, and non-indigenous use the shaping devices, the visual shaping devices, like layout and color, palette, place, balloon placement, the lines, perspective, facial expression, all of that, to convey emotion, to propel the story forward. And this is important, especially when you think about the history of non-Indigenous comics creators doing such a lousy job of geometrizing Indigenous subjectivities and experiences. So it was really, really important for me to bring the artfulness of the drawing and the how this is the main kind of motor behind the storytelling, but also a part of that movement against a long history of being kind of represented in many cases as Indigenous, but having the kind of color of criollo or a white light-skinned person, or even the bone structure that doesn't really reflect our Indigenous ancestry, but rather tips the balance always toward a more Caucasian aesthetic.
So as we move through this, let's start with this part one, where you sort of talk about these mainstreamed indigeneities. And so can you talk a bit about some of the pieces that are in there? I don't know if there's five in this section, if you want to highlight a few or sort of give an overview of some of them. But let's talk about this sort of first part that you were trying to get at, sort of the othering and sort of situating this movement.
Yeah. And Rebecca, if you don't mind, I'll just mention a couple of other things that are important. You know, this book, while I'm pulling together a lot of important scholarship, and it's both transnational in its kind of approach, and at the same time respectful of regional and sort of communal based understandings of the differences across cultures and experiences. Transnational in the sense that there's a shared history of colonization, empire building, et cetera, across the globe that Indigenous peoples and creators share. But at the same time, these are all kind of grown in very specific soils in very different ways. So with that in mind, going into the spaces of even understanding how a kind of comics industrial complex on a global level has itself tried to kind of force and contain indigeneity in ways that, you know, reflect and even mirror the kind of global politics of empire building, right? So this first section really showing us that. So on the kind of global level, what's been happening with comics, especially coming out of Western spaces like the US, in terms of representing indigeneity or the other, a kind of orientalist, primitivist paradigm at work within the comics industrial complex. This first section is really all about teasing that out. And we go into with, we launch with Breena Clark Gray, who's, you know, a very well-known, respected comic scholar, especially working in the space of Canada. And, you know, this is really important because she, you know, Breena really, like, you know, breaks down how indigeneity has been appropriated in these particular, in Canada, and kind of peddled, pushed back out there as somehow the representations of indigenous, you know, in Canada, and how it really kind of does damage, you know. So, you know, she looks at things like Alpha Flight. She looks at, you know, other spaces where there is this tendency to metabolize to indigeneity, to package it, to market it, and to sweep aside the details and the specificities of the histories of indigenous peoples of Canada. Justice League. So all of those kind of superhero comics that were created that, you know, do that Mohican shaman move, right? Where, you know, the shaman is somehow mystical and frozen in time and, you know, can call the spirits, et cetera, in this very mystical way as a way of containing indigeneity in these kinds of stereotypes, right? Freezing in time, freezing in the past, and not really showing that, in fact, indigeneity is something that is much more complicated, living and breathing in a present tense moment. It's also important because it shows the contrast between a kind of cultural appropriative move that says, oh, look, let's pay homage or respect to indigeneity, even if it's in this kind of stereotypical way. And at the same time, the very real politics and policy making that continue to expropriate lands and to oppress and exploit and even continue to commit acts of genocide against indigenous First Nation peoples. So yeah, so, you know, and moving in, you know, from there, we have the historians. We have historians that look at Australasia, very specifically places like Australia, and we have and New Zealand and the Maori indigeneity and the histories of reconstructing that story in ways that are also, you know, very denigrative, that contain and that distill and reconstruct. Again, going from, you know, comics that you find in Australia, comics like Skippy the Bush Kangaroo, but also looking at comics that are, you know, part of the X-Men series, the Aboriginal Superhero Gateway, right? And the his particular powers and how they are problematic, how they kind of create a mishmash of Aboriginal beliefs, because the, you know, the creator of Gateway didn't do any kind of even a modicum of homework in the reconstruction of that character and the construction of that. And other comics, Hicksville, a really famous one, you know, non-Indigenous created comics that really shaped the imaginary and the images that were circulating about, you know, Maori, Indigenous, New Zealand, and Australian peoples. You know, they end with on a really hopeful note that fortunately there are many more Indigenous creators out there, you know, in New Zealand and Australia pushing against this excess of Indigenous imagery that has contained and denigrated Indigenous peoples' experiences and identities. So yeah, so really, you know, kind of sweeping through. And then someone like Kevin Patrick, the scholar, you know, looking carefully at the Phantom, I think is really interesting too, because he reminds us that, we're not just passive absorptive sponges, that in fact, when there's denigrative stereotyping in this comics industrial complex, and even when there's something like the Phantom that does the same kind of work that I just mentioned in terms of, careless and even destructive reconstructions of indigeneity, that there are indigenous creators who have taken up the Phantom and repurposed and recreated in ways that, speak to and from Maori indigeneity perspective subjectivities. So that, just a reminder that yes, this stuff is not good, but at the same time, we're not just passively absorbing it, that there are creators out there who are re-spinning it in ways that, make it really sort of interesting, make this spaces interesting again. And then, as I mentioned, this Terra South section really kind of moves us into the South Americas, the hemisphere that makes up the South of the Americas, and really getting at some of the incredible comics there, like Chola Power and, Daniel Parada's Zots and others that are really, really doing the work both on the shaping, visual shaping, and also in the storytelling and the, say, what's being put in front of the panel in front of us to kind of create these incredible stories. Chola Power. Wow. I love that comic book. It's like, we have a indigenous, superhero, and she, very much rooted in her, in her, pre-conquest mythologies, same thing with Parada's Zots. There's Jorge Santos, and we have several other people, scholars working in this particular space and kind of moving to that Mesoamerican speculative reconstruction of indigeneity. I don't know. It's this volume for me was, I am still learning from it. It's just mind blowing. What is happening out there? What has happened? But more powerfully, what is being created out there to enrich and complicate this comics book storytelling space? I'll just keep talking a little bit, because Lee Francis wrote a really beautiful foreword, and he mentions tribalography, a concept, approach, a method for positioning works by indigenous creators as central to the discourse and valid on their own merits for critical scholarship and dialogue. And I'm hoping that graphic indigeneity is that for other people. I know it is for me, and I know it is for the scholars that contributed to it. But really, opening this space for this deep exploration of indigenous works at the same time as kind of showing, this long history of how indigeneity has been boxed in, contained, and in that way also kind of erased or made safe, and how these indigenous creators around the world are really pushing against that and also clearing absolutely brand new, beautiful new paths.
One of the things that I really appreciated, and it might move into sort of part three more than any of the others, is coming from a background of looking at and researching zines and sort of other underground spaces, I loved looking at sort of the way in which some of these comic book artists and some of the discussion around using that sort of non-traditional space, right? Mm-hmm. And pushing on that. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that in the context, you know, of some of these narratives and pieces in here about using that sort of underground and resistance space to sort of push against some of these larger narratives.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, I mentioned how graphic indigeneity is a movement. And today I see it as a movement against the comics industrial complex that has gotten it so willfully wrong when they have kind of pushed into this space, either by appropriating or deliberate erasure or through hyper-exaggeration and stereotype. And so by movement, I also mean that the creators are working across all different genres and in all these different kinds of creative spaces, multimodal, zine, maybe more traditional comic book, superhero action layout and graphiation, right? So line work, balloon placement, et cetera. It's everywhere. It's the autobiographical, it's the historical, it's Gord Hill's 500 Years of Resistance comic book. It's right. It's Zots that I had mentioned. It's the superheroes like, you know, Tribal Force and Aragon Starr's Super Indian, the team that put together Chickasaw, et cetera. All, you know, many of which are being published through Native Realities Press, Lee Francis. And so we have to see it as a movement, and because it's not something that's identified by form, format, material, shape, zine, comic in a certain way, right? It's all of these things. Plus it's all sorts, it's all the genres. And it's a movement because it's political. One way or the other, it's political because it's storytelling that intensifies and puts on the map from the indigenous subject position traditions that have been either co-opted or wiped away. So, yeah, I think that all of these speak to that question of the power of graphic indigeneity on the singular, and then as a collective, seen as a collective that's moving against the comics industrial complex, and that is also opening new spaces for storytelling.
Another thing that I want to sort of highlight, because we could spend all day highlighting different areas, but one of the other things I really appreciated was some of the look at female either protagonists or writers, right? So I think of Dear Woman, but you also talked about, you just mentioned, and now I'm blanking, La Chola, was that?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Chola Power. Like
yes, right. So there's these also thinking women often are on the outskirts or in comics, right? And so I'd love for you to talk about where you see some of these representations, even though Dear Woman is sort of this monstrous represent, but still wonderful, talking about some of these representations as well.
So it's not just kind of gender in a traditional sense. I think what you will see is if you go dive into some of these comics created by our indigenous brothers and sisters, those also who are sensitive and do their homework, you'll see actually a greater sense of what gender can be, a greater spectrum of what gender can be. So not just gender as kind of identified by, say, you know, biological genitalia or even role, kind of conventional role models, but seeing spectrums, so masculinity. So even something like Aragon Starr's Super Indian, that is we're seeing a different kind of masculinity in the sort of body, the space of, you know, Super Indian, even in the drawing of Super Indian. We're seeing kind of a move, a push against conventions of binarization, male, female, masculine, feminine, and we're seeing much more spectrum masculinities, spectrum femininities, and the power that comes from going back to Mesoamerican pre-colonial, pre-conquest spaces that didn't create binaries of, you know, gender, binaries of sexuality as we see them and know them today, and recuperating and putting those into the comic book spaces today and the characterizations and the protagonists that are being put out there as a way to also, you know, create this resistance to normative patterns of reading superheroes or reading protagonists in very specific ways. So that's how I would answer that question. It's a little more general, but I think maybe a little more generative.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I wanted to sort of, you touched on, but I'd love for you to talk about a bit more is, right, we often do see comics in these roles, the superhero genre becomes this, you know, one that people go to. But like, I'd say one of the text in here that I really appreciated was Enrique Garcia's piece that is looking at sort of Puerto Rican comics and heritage. Mm. And so can you talk a bit about like the role of comics in, like I said, you talked about this a bit, but I'd love for you to, you know, sort of talk about and highlight that role of comics beyond that superhero and sort of grounding and creating narratives and discussions of heritage and that kind of.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's there's so much in Enrique's work that's super powerful. And I know this is the seed to a bigger project on Taino in Puerto Rican comic book spaces, the indigenous Taino. But what's really, I think, significant and powerful about this particular chapter is his focus on the comic Touré and the making of the recuperation of indigenous ancestral pasts in ways that are vital and alive for young readers, and vital and alive, you know, for young readers primarily, and of course, you know, parents that are also invited into that space, or adults that are invited into that space, and showing really how, you know, we can kind of be at once critical of the way a Spanish colonial mentality has placed itself in and on Puerto Rican readers through long histories of imperialism and colonization, and do it in an entertaining and fun way. And he, you know, I think this is like pretty significant. You know, he kind of goes to the early readers, which in a way is the place where comics can and do the most powerful and important work. And I don't mean that by, you know, in the sense of like propaganda being fed to kids. I mean that in the sense of really kind of taking children, young readers, on journeys that are respectful, recuperative of our pre-conquest ancestral past, things that they don't get in their classrooms, things that are histories that are not shared, that are erased from official textbooks in Puerto Rican classrooms, and a real kind of embrace and recognition of Puerto Rico's mestizaje, the three races that make up, you know, Puerto Rico today: African, Taino, and Spanish. And, you know, the comics that are being created canon do this. It's pretty remarkable. He also mentions a friend of mine, Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez's La Borinquena. And, you know, again, that takes a kind of superhero mode. But again, very, very much a move to bring Spanish, Taino, and African ancestral culture, histories, heritage into the characterization of the superhero, the Latinx, Afro-Latinx Borinquena. So all of these things are so radical and so incredible and so important.
Yes, as someone who works with teachers or students who are going to be teachers, this piece in particular really spoke to something that could be used and really, right, we often, there are a number of things out there about comics in the classroom and using comics, but not in a way that really pushes people to, I think, like this this collection does, but pushing teachers to really think about these representations. And so this was, for me, a really nice way to sort of highlight that.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, it's so important to have to, you know, I do this every year in the fall. I have SoulCon, which is my Brown, Black, and Indigenous Comics Expo. And I bus in K through 12 kids, and I also bring the teachers in to learn from the creators themselves that fly in, drive in, train in to Columbus for these 3 days. And it's with the teachers and the kids that I see all of the sort of incredible light bulbs going off and, you know, oh, I didn't know I could own my story. I could tell my story, or teachers realizing that they can use a comic like La Borinquena to, you know, take the children on a journey that then the teacher can enrich and add to by talking about Taíno history and culture, and then, you know, also the dark side, the genocide and colonization and histories of internalizing kind of whiteness, and how that sort of functions in, you know, indigenous Latinx, Afro-Caribbean, America hemispheric spaces.
Yes, yes. And I often, and this just highlighted, especially going back to sort of part one, but like in reading a number of these pieces, just highlighted the ways, highlighted the ways in which the U.S. sort of, like you talk about the comic industrial complex, right, sort of takes over and likes to make sure that we are the savior in many ways, and that I appreciate all the ways in which these authors sort of represent and show that there's a larger picture out there, and there's a larger, and there's other narratives besides that sort of grand narrative we often see in U.S. popular
culture. Yeah. And also speaking of popular, right? I mean, and I mentioned the kids and how they are get so excited, and they get really excited too to meet the creators and to see themselves, right? See Brown and Black creators, like there with them, teaching them. They just don't ever see that, especially in a place like Columbus. But popular culture as the kind of, you know, I think for me anyway, and for many scholars today, I think that this is really the vital place for a kind of interventionist scholarship to happen, because the popular necessarily pushes us outside of the comforts of an ivory tower classroom space constantly. It's asking us to understand this, you know, within the sort of space of the popular, and those spaces for like people like me and you are Latinx and Black and Indigenous and so on.
So another, I have one other piece that I really like to talk about, and we can talk about others if you want, but it's the final one, right? By Candida Rifkin and Jessica Fontaine, which is a I don't know if it's a 180, but it moves us in a very different direction. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about this piece, about how they, those, you know, right, you talk, they talk a bit about multimodalities and using sort of videos and music as well as the comics. So can you talk a bit about that and a bit about this piece?
Sure. I mean, you know, the big, the kind of the $1 million question, or the thing that some of us often struggle with when doing scholarship on comics, especially comics that reconstruct trauma that's linked to histories of genocide, trauma against, and that happen within the violence that happens within our communities, is how do we do that in a respectful way? And how do the comics use the visuals, or in this case, visuals and kind of multimodal storytelling shaping devices to represent in trauma and indigenous experiences without taking away the kind of horror of what it means, you know, to be the subject of this gendered violence, the brutal gendered violence in this case of settler colonialism. And so, yeah, they do a really careful job at kind of walking this tight rope of being at once respectful and then enriching our understanding of how comics, on this kind of multimodal way, use realism, visual realism, auditory realism, to intensify the horror, and at the same time not sensationalize the horror, the trauma. And that's the real trick here. You know, how do you tell those stories in ways that don't kind of slip into the business as usual comic book industrial complex, which will go to those places of trauma simply as a way to sensationalize or to create kind of origin story and then leave it behind. And they really show us how, you know, the comic Will I See, in the all the kind of comic book shaping devices like the use of the gutter, etc., create both the presencing of trauma and our experience as an audience of this, and at the same time a reminder that this is also ultimately something that is private and that will not ultimately finally satisfy a reader's hunger for kind of trauma porn or the kind of sensationalist storytelling that we see in mainstream comics.
Mm-hmm. No, and I thought that for me, that was this, that what you're talking about there, sort of this idea of how do we experience, how does the audience sort of see it and have to wrestle with it, right? There's not for me, this piece felt like there was not, that it's left unfinished, right? That mm-hmm. you're not going to come to this with mm-hmm. being told like this is the answer, or
right.
That's the best way.
No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean that, you know, it's remarkable because they bring like this toolkit from comics, really from the visual art of storytelling through comics, as well as a real sensitivity to how, you know, it employs video. Kind of the use of motion graphics and zooms over the images to at once kind of bring readers, viewers in, and at the same time to remind us in this kind of meta way that, well, we're the kind of the voice, the subjectivity, the identities here are finally our own and not something that will be easily consumed.
So, I mean, we could probably talk about this collection for a long time, but we've been talking for a while. What do you think, before I ask sort of my final question I usually ask, Where do you see your collection, right, is sort of starting this dialogue? So where do you see this going? Are you, you know, like, what are you hoping comes from this collection? And what do you want the, right, I'm asking lots of loaded questions, I guess. What do you want the readers to get out of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we still have a lot of work to do in the spaces that are here. So the kind of hemispheric Americas and then Australasia. But of course, the shared experience of colonization, empire building, you know, is a global experience. And, you know, even as I mentioned, even if, as I mentioned, there it's important to recognize specificities of historical and cultural kind of difference within that. And so, you know, we need to hear more. We need to see more, you know, about places like the Philippines and Hawaii as a kind of pan-Pacific space of comics creation in the same dual mode that I was just, that I laid out here, where it looks at, you know, the representations done of those spaces and then those indigenous creators with working, you know, in to sort of push against that, the movements across these different other spaces that have been the subject of colonial and empire building violence. So I think this is the beginning of, you know, further work that can really, you know, bring to the fore the indigeneity and indigenous foundations at work, you know, in other regional geographic spaces to vitally inform comics making.
So my final question usually is, if you have things you're working on now or something else you sort of want to push forward or promote, I know we're in an odd time with COVID, but if there are things you sort of want to talk about what you're working on next or.
Yeah. So I have, along with this, I just published the Oxford Handbook of Comics Studies, comic book studies, and also gender sexuality in comic studies with Rutledge, the Rutledge companion. And I'm just sending to press today a big volume on Latinx TV in the 21st century. But basically, you know, in all the work that I'm doing in my scholarship right now, it's really to kind of breathe or help breathe and open new spaces of scholarly inquiry to enrich our understanding of what is happening by Latinx, Indigenous, Black, and other creators today, and less attention being paid to how we have been contained, controlled, surveillanced, and even erased in the past by others. So really kind of bringing a new optic into these spaces that celebrates and enriches and nuances the narrative shapings and the narratives made by folks within the story worlds, the subjectivities and identities within this, you know, that are authors of the story worlds themselves that have been otherwise swept to the side or gatekept from, you know, publishing, televisual, TV shaping, etc. So that's what I've been really doing. But also, I published my first kids' book this summer called The Adventures of Chupacabra Charlie, and I'm currently turning that into an animation film that will be released at Christmas. I've just written the second part of Chupacabra Charlie and His Adventures. The first one tells the story of Chupacabra Charlie and Lupe, who set out on an adventure that involves freeing children from cages. And so, yeah, continuing to do my creative work. I've also got Labyrinths Born, my first graphic novel that's about to be completed and go into production. And of course, continuing to publish the mini graphic novels, memoirs, and histories through my Latino Graphics Trade Press series.
So you've got a lot going on.
Yes.
So, but it's been wonderful talking with you again, Frederick Louis.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks for being here.